The topic for week 11 is academia as a commons. And the themes we're going to discuss today are how historically academia has functioned as a commons, and then how in the past 20, 30, 40 years, there's been a corporate enclosure of academia, mostly as corporations have entered into partnership agreements with universities to do research. The Bayh-Dole Act in 1980 was a key aspect of this. So we'll talk about how the commercialization of academic research, scientific research, medical research has increasingly intensified, and such that the credibility and trustworthiness of a lot of science is now suspect because of the extreme enclosure of the academic commons. And then finally, we'll talk about some of the ways that academia is pushing back, developing its own commons resources, reclaiming its own commons in a way through open educational resources. There is an open educational resources movement, or OER, that is doing such things as open courseware, which are curricula that's available to everyone online, open textbooks, the One Laptop Per Child project, and many others whose goal is to make knowledge as accessible as possible, which, of course, is one of the key goals of academia. But let's start with the history of academia as a commons. A lot of that got its start in the post-World War II era, when coming out of the war, FDR and his advisors were contemplating how to put scientific research to best use, because it was clear after the war that science and technology would be a major contributor to national power and economic vitality. Well, a lot of the impetus for creating academia as a commons, in which scientists and researchers would have a fair degree of autonomy and be able to focus on basic research and not simply do applied, commercially oriented research, a lot of the impetus for that vision came from Vannevar Bush, who was a major figure in the FDR administration. In 1945, he issued a report called Science, the Endless Frontier. And this set forth a new national policy for government-academic partnerships, with the federal government providing really kind of open-ended blue-sky research on a massive scale, and really minimal interference by either the government or industry. As Vannevar Bush warned, industry is generally inhibited by preconceived goals, by its own clearly defined standards, and by the constant pressure of commercial necessity. So essentially, they wanted to allow science to explore the frontier and to develop new sorts of insights that individual companies, because of their own competitive pressures and limited budgets, couldn't or wouldn't. Bush wanted autonomy and flexibility for scientists and very few interventions. Now, the military, to be fair, had its own share of very specific and applied goals in directing research. But at the same time, there was an awareness that letting scientists have certain independence could develop really a lot of breakthrough technologies, such things as radar and penicillin, blood plasma discoveries, all were a product of this mode of open research. And we should talk a little bit about why science and academic science is a kind of commons, or more accurately, we might call it a gift economy, which is a special class of commonses. And a gift economy is a social community in which people make contributions and over time expect to get benefits, but there's no quid pro quo, no even exchange that I give you this and I get that in return. There's no money. There's no market exchange. It's more of being a member in good standing and contributing to the community, and over time you will be taken care of. We discussed, you may recall, the gift economy, I believe, in week 3 or 4 of this series. Now, this isn't to say that the participants in a gift economy are saintly altruists or don't need to earn a living. But what it is to say is that people who generate value through a gift economy are pursuing their self-interest in a different way. And the significant benefits that they generate simply can't be generated by money, or measured by money, I should say. Now, that's exactly what scientists and academic researchers do. They may earn their livings through the market indirectly or through their institutional employment at a university, but their standing and their credibility comes from participating in a scientific commons, in a commons of practitioners. And this community hosts open collaboration and debate, and the community makes its own collective reckoning of the value of people's contributions and the procedures that they've used to reach their conclusions. And this creates a shared body of knowledge. And this is precisely why academia is such a powerful mode of creativity and generativity, because there is this shared collaboration over time. There's this commitment to shared ideals and procedures, the scientific method, certain community policing of ethics so that there isn't plagiarism or people stealing other people's research ideas. You get individual credit, but it all accrues to the discipline itself, the community. That's why people's papers in scientific or academic work are called contributions. So it helps to understand academia as this non-market paradigm for creating valuable things. It's a way of mobilizing community judgment and ethical scrutiny to proceed in a trustworthy way. And it's one reason why academic findings are so highly trusted, because they're not being done in the marketplace where somebody has a clear self-interest. They're done in an open fashion by a large community of people who scrutinize the outcomes. So it's important to have that background as we go forward to see what, in fact, has been lost over the past 30 or 40 years. I should just backtrack to say, at a certain time, like in the 50s, it was considered somewhat antisocial, if not odd, to try to own one's innovative academic research. When Jonas Salk and his colleagues invented the polio vaccine, a reporter asked him, well, who owns the vaccine? And he said, well, the people, I would say. There is no patent. Could you patent the sun? And this ethic really continued for several more decades. In the 1970s, for example, Stanford University's Stanley Cohen and Herbert Boyer, two Nobel Prize winners, they had no interest in patenting the gene splicing techniques that they developed in 1973, until a Stanford University lawyer approached them and advised them to patent it. Cesar Milstein, who won the Nobel Prize for developing monoclonal antibody technologies in 1975, similarly didn't patent his work. But that was sort of the end of an era, in the sense that in 1980, the chemical, pharmaceutical, and electronics industries began to lobby for change in the federal law governing research. Historically, federally sponsored research was committed to the public domain. It could be used by anyone. It couldn't be locked up. It was considered something that belonged to the American people, who, after all, had financed it. But these industries wanted to try to piggyback on federal research and take it private. The way it worked is a lot of universities would produce some really valuable, interesting research. And wouldn't it be great, the companies figured, if we could own the patent on it and lock it up for ourselves? And the way that those industries got this change in the law passed was by depicting America as suffering in the competition with Japan. So there was a lot of xenophobic tone to the discussion, and how America was losing its competitive edge and innovation to Japan. which was depicted as this fierce, fierce competitor. And this is why we had to give away the publicly funded research to private companies, so that they could commercialize it more readily, so they could take research that was supposedly sitting on the shelf gathering dust and make it a competitive product in the marketplace. So Senators Bob Dole and Birch Bayh introduced this legislation, and through a lot of subterfuges, it passed in 1980. The goal, again, was to accelerate the commercialization of research by granting automatic ownership rights in taxpayer-funded research. They depicted the public domain of knowledge in academia as this treacherous quicksand pit in which discoveries sink beyond the reach of the private sector, as one commentator put it. But there were also a number of people like Senator Russell Long of Louisiana who said that this was one of the most radical and far-reaching giveaways I have ever seen. And Admiral Rickover of the Navy said that pointed out that the law would require the public to pay twice, first through their payment of taxes, which paid for the research, and then through higher monopoly prices and restricted supply when the patented invention reached the marketplace. So this was really a historic juncture in how huge amounts of federal research would be owned and who would be able to benefit from it. It was really also a time in when the whole set of marketplace norms and relationships were essentially imposed on academic life and research, because universities soon saw that this just wasn't a way to help out industry and make the nation stronger economically. It was a way that they themselves as institutions could start to reap new revenue streams, how they could become market players. So what used to be a gift economy of researchers started to have more contractual relationships and more equity stakes and profits. The prospect of gaining private profits and equity became a driver of research. And this in turn started to change the whole ethic of how researchers related to each other. Do you really want to share your research with somebody if they might rip it off and take it private and make a lot of money? And so you got to see more secrecy and greater rivalry among researchers about who would get the patent rights for new research, and rivalry between the researchers and the university administrations over who would own things. So there was no longer the general presumption that research would flow into the public domain and be free for anyone to use. Instead, you would have huge swaths of knowledge that would start to be fenced off into privately owned plots, mostly owned by corporations. And in fact, over the past 30 years, since 1980, there's been a tenfold increase in patents that universities have acquired. The industry funding to academia to fund research has gone up more than five times than it was prior to 1980. And in fact, there has been more commercial value extracted from universities. You could say there have been some genuine benefits, as certain research has more quickly focused on the moved into the marketplace, and universities now have a more standardized way of what's called technology transfer, moving that knowledge into the marketplace and patenting it. This is not all bad, but what is far more problematic is the way that the corporate relationship with academia has started to erode the gift economy, which has its own set of values and value that it creates. For example, when a corporation gives a grant to a major university to do a multi-million dollar research project, it will frequently insist that it be able to review the book manuscript or journal article before it's published. Or it might insist upon a delay in publication of the research findings so that it can file a patent first. Or it might assert legal claims to own any future scientific discoveries that flow from that knowledge. Or it might refuse to license any follow-on research discoveries to other parties. And oftentimes there are non-disclosure agreements that prevent the researchers from sharing their this discoveries or materials with each other. So you start to see, as property rights and market norms and the lure of big money come to academia in a more systematic way, that the ethic within academic science and academic medicine starts to change. You start to get a warping of research priorities. One of the more notorious cases occurred when the drug company Novartis, which is now Syngenta, gave UC Berkeley $25 million. And it wanted the first right to negotiate patent licenses on one-third of the research program at the Department of Plant and Microbial Biology at UC Berkeley. Well, this created quite a firestorm of concern, because people were understandably worried that the department had been more or less annexed to serve the company's pharmaceutical and biotech interests. And in fact, at one point, a microbial biologist, Ignacio Chapella, didn't receive tenure, and there were many accusations that it was because he had published research that was critical of genetically modified organisms. He had done a study that showed that genetically modified corn had contaminated the native maize in Mexico. And there was a big dispute about the significance of his findings, with both sides claiming the other had impure motives. But the point is that the trustworthiness of the scientific process was contaminated once the lure of big money had been injected into the biology department at UC Berkeley. And this is not an isolated episode. There are many instances in which researchers who were conscientiously studying a given topic found that their research had embarrassing results, and that this had consequences for money that otherwise might have been donated to the university or to other sponsored research. David Kern was a researcher at Brown University who discovered a new sort of lung disease associated with textile fibers. And it was had serious public health consequences, but he was prohibited by his sponsored research contract from publishing the results. He eventually did, and even publicly presented the results, but Brown University eventually failed to renew his job contract. And there was an apparent retribution for him speaking out honestly about his research findings. There was another case of a woman who had at the University of Toronto, who a medical professor, Nancy Oliveira, who found evidence that a substance for genetic blood disease that afflicts millions of people was ineffective or less effective than other drugs. And this was, of course, not a welcome discovery by the drug industry that produced that drug. So you start to get an accumulation of these kinds of stories. Then you start to find that that research priorities start to get shifted, that the focus, what used to be a focus on basic research, exploratory research on the unknown, starts to get warped to serve more short-term applied commercial interests. So that, you know, in a sense, many academic departments are becoming the junior partners of the corporate interest, and the kind of breakthrough analyses that academia has historically produced are simply not being funded anymore. People aren't being allowed to study it. Two cautionary examples are how the genetics revolution and the computer science revolution were both funded through the basic research funding of the federal government. And it was only because that money was there and because scientists had the autonomy to explore things in a less commercial way that they made these breakthrough discoveries that allowed those fields to emerge as scientific fields and as industries that could build on that knowledge. Nowadays, with so much of academic research focused on short-term commercial applied research, you don't have the same kinds of far-reaching breakthroughs that we once had. You also have the problem of property rights causing a paralysis in research. When you have so many patents being asserted, it can be hard for researchers to do research without fearing they're violating someone's patent. There was, for example, a new kind of genetically engineered rice that was intended to resist a tropical virus. But it couldn't be sold because there were as many as 34 different patent holders who needed to have their rights cleared. Permission had to be approved. So this is an example of what happens when the marketplace norms start to take over the academic commons. The kinds of property rights intrude upon the freedom to explore research, and then it skews things to commercial interests. Instead of studying integrated pest management or organic farming, for example, there'll be more focus on genetically modified crops because that's something perceived to have greater commercial interest. So the market needs, rather than public needs, start to take preeminence. You also find conflicts of interest, ethical conflicts of interest, where sometimes researchers or their universities will have an equity stake in the companies that are sponsoring the research. And so corners will be cut, data might be flawed, or in the case of a infamous UPenn series of tests using experimental gene therapy, the researchers had an equity stake in the outcome of their findings, and they took one ethical shortcut that resulted in the fatality of one of the test subjects. Well, this is just the tip of the iceberg when money starts to skew the integrity of the research itself. And many people are charging that academia is actively selling its credibility to raise money. There are many centers that are largely funded by corporate interests. At Harvard University, the School of Public Health had a Center for Risk Management, where 60% of its funding came from the chemical and pesticide makers. And there were some predictable outcomes and results in, say, the cost-benefit analyses that they produced about the value of certain chemicals or the risks of certain chemicals. Historically, it's been presumed that academics are disinterested and that their data and research is open to scrutiny and debate. But as more corporate sponsorships take hold, that's not necessarily so. The companies might own the data. The companies might suppress the publications, publication of that information. And the trustworthiness of the whole research is more suspect. In a recent Boston Review article that Marcia Angel, the former editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, wrote, she's been studying this topic for many, many years and has pointed out how bias is introduced when you have so much corporate sponsorship. She noted that of a review of 74 clinical trials of antidepressants, for example, found that 37 of 38 positive studies, meaning ones that showed effectiveness, were published. But of the 36 negative studies, 33 of them were either not published or they were published in a form that conveyed a positive outcome, such as making a claim of effectiveness that wasn't supported by the data. In other words, the corporate influence on what gets studied, what the research protocols will be, when it's published, whether it's published, under what terms it's published, all of them affect lots of decisions down the pike, for example, in the regulatory process. It affects how FDA makes its decisions about which drugs will be approved or not. You know, if the drug company can affect what research protocols will be built into the design of an experiment, it can change how that is perceived, the drug being tested is perceived, and make it more likely that it can be approved by the FDA. So you have, there's a whole whole literature, in fact, on how Big Pharma uses its money to influence academic medicine. That's the gist of Martha Angel's 2010 article in the Boston Review. And she notes that the disclosures of financial interests that researchers may have in a drug they're studying are rare or often not required. And it's very common for academic medical researchers to have all sorts of money relationships with a drug company. She cites such things as joining advisory boards and speakers bureaus and entering into patent and royalty arrangements and agreeing to be the listed authors of articles ghostwritten by interested companies and promoting drugs and devices at company-sponsored symposiums and allowing them yourself to be to go on junkets in luxurious resort settings, ostensibly for educational purposes, and on and on. It's really quite a sobering and distressing picture of how much of academic medicine has been compromised. And for me, this points out why it's so imperative that we can understand academic inquiry as a commons, because it's a whole different structure for creating value. Non-monetary value, mind you, but important value, because the trustworthiness of the outcomes, the rigor of the scientific method, the collective judgment of dozens or hundreds of expert scientists, all of that is something that the market cannot produce. The market has other ways of producing value, its own type of value, but academia has its own, and it's important to keep them distinct and separate. Academic research needs to maintain its own sovereignty in controlling how it creates things, instead of allowing itself to be simply annexed by the market as a junior partner. And the problem is that this ethic starts to feed on itself, because no one wants to be the last sucker left committing one's research to the public domain. And so you start to get this momentum among academic scientists to patent their knowledge, to strike deals, to get consultancies, to be expert advisors to major corporations, to do research that is more applied and short-term oriented and not the upstream long-term research. So in some ways it's a happy conspiracy in the sense that the large research universities, many of the top scientists themselves, and the corporations are all quite happy and mutually served by this arrangement. But of course, the public is not well served, and the long-term future of research and discovery is not well served. And this is really the bottom line, the lesson from all this, that the academic commons needs to maintain its own sovereignty and integrity if it's going to produce the kinds of things that we've historically looked to it for. If we allow this tsunami of commercialization to proceed, for everything, all sorts of knowledge to be owned and controlled privately, we kill the goose that produced the golden egg. We don't allow the shared collaboration to produce the rich, rich knowledge, the breakthrough discoveries, the new innovations that historically it has produced. So it's important to understand that, yes, academia and the market can collaborate. The market does have a role in engaging with this knowledge, but it's not as if that academia needs to hand over the keys to its whole enterprise to commercial interests to do this, or even make as many compromises as they have. It's a sad day when major universities start to be pilloried for making money off of patents on AIDS drugs rather than committing them to the public good. That's why universities get tax breaks. There's all sorts of tax exemptions for them because presumably they're serving the public good. If they're going to start to become crypto market actors trying to commercialize their research at the expense of the public good, it really is double dipping and shortchanging the public. So this is the quandary that we are at in the United States and much of the world today, with academics being enclosed. And it's a major challenge. We need to think of ways to reform the Bayh-Dole Act so that we can make clear that the widest dissemination of knowledge is the goal, not maximum profits for companies. Jennifer Washburn, who wrote the really path-breaking book University Inc., The Corporate Corruption of Higher Education, points out that it would be worthwhile to get an independent, to establish an independent third-party licensing body to license academic research rather than allowing universities to be picked off one by one by corporate interests. And the universities ought to impose stricter conflict of interest laws so that the integrity of their research can be more relied upon. It's interesting that in the past 5 or 6 years, there has been a flurry of new books on this topic because I think there's a greater awareness of how serious the problem is. One of the more noteworthy ones was Derek Bach's Universities in the Marketplace, The Commercialization of Higher Education, which explores the full gamut of companies taking over universities in terms of sports, marketing of sports logos on all the teams and sports activities, the selling of credit cards to students who are seen as this captive cohort to whom they can be marketed, getting a lot of students way over their heads in debt, and then the usual retail marketing to students. Another really worthwhile book is Corianne McSherry's Who Owns Academic Work? Battling for Control of Intellectual Property, which is about the many battles for, especially of copyright control within universities. For example, are university lectures something that are owned by the professor? Do students need to have a license to take notes from university lectures? Are we going to use a discourse of ownership and property to talk about what transpires within academia, or can we find another way of talking about it? Well, I'll mention two other books worth looking at. One is Sheldon Krimsky's Science in the Public Interest, Has the Lure of Profits Corrupted Biomedical Research? And then a nice anthology of essays called Buying In or Selling Out, The Commercialization of the American Research University, edited by Donald Stein. It's a topic that deserves not just more study and publishing, but more action. And unfortunately, there has been distressingly little action in reforming many of these troubling abuses going on. But I wanted to get to one of the more hopeful signs, which is the rise of the open educational resources movement and some of the innovations of open access publishing and a number of new types of science commonses. Let's start with open educational research. The OER movement is this very sprawling, diverse movement which is attempting to make knowledge more accessible and available, usually for free or on a low-cost basis, to everyone. And they are trying to exploit digital technologies and the internet to do this. So, for example, textbook prices. A lot of commercial publishers create these overblown textbooks that cost $120, $150. They do contrived updates every couple of years so that students have to buy the new edition and can't use the used books. What's a student to do? Well, if you're a community college student struggling to get into struggling to pay your way there. Sometimes you have to drop out of school because you can't afford the textbooks. So a number of community colleges, especially in the California area, have started an open textbook movement where the textbook is collectively created and owned and can be produced for the cost of printing on demand. And it's a way of radically reducing the costs and for the academic discipline owning the text itself and not being hostage to commercial publishers. More broadly, this is being done with open access scholarly publishing, which spans the gamut of science, the humanities, and points in between. Open access publishing is also a model of publishing that seeks to make journal articles free or very low cost in perpetuity. So instead of a library having to pay an expensive subscription for the paper editions or an expensive, what amounts to a rental for the digital editions, the published work is available for free online forever. And there are many variations to open access publishing. And for those who wish to explore it further, Peter Suber's Open Access News is the definitive online source. But the point is that open access journals are flourishing as a competitive alternative to commercial journals, which are increasingly prohibitively expensive. Within the library world, there's been the so-called serials crisis, where the cost of subscriptions is so great that libraries are having to stop subscribing to many journals. And this, of course, is not helping academic exchange and debate. A scientific journal might cost $5,000 or $10,000 a year, for example. But many disciplines are finding that if they band together and pay the upfront costs, which are far more modest than the commercial journals, they can publish the work and make it available for free. And the work will be more widely seen and cited than many of the commercial journal articles. Now, the problem is that many commercial journals have established reputations and cachet and are more prestigious. And that's where, of course, an academic wishes to publish, to be better seen and recognized. Unfortunately, many of those journals could just as easily publish on an open access basis if the major figures would simply move to a new journal or create a new journal. But of course, this involves lots of administrative and financial issues of how to reorient things. Sometimes the learned societies who publish journals are dependent upon the revenue from their journal, their print journal. So it's a legitimately difficult transition. However, some, especially in the scientific world, certain funders are folding in money to their research grants with the requirement that the research be published in an open access way. And this is stimulating a great deal of open access journal publishing. The National Institutes for Health, for example, over the objections of commercial publishers, now requires that federally sponsored research be available in an open access format after 1 year of its first publication in a commercial journal. This too is helping to promote this new ethic. And if only because of the serious economic efficiencies of doing this, it's seen as the wave of the future. It's just a matter of how to navigate the transition. But there are obvious benefits for academics and scientists because their work can be seen by anyone or the general public who perhaps is not subscribing to an arcane journal of certain types of cancer, for example. Yet if you or your relative get cancer, now you can start to see these journal articles if they're in an open access journal. There are now more than 5,000 open access journals. A great many of them are peer-reviewed and every bit as reliable as the more prestigious journals. But it's still somewhat at the early to mid stage of this transition to the digital publishing world. And a lot of uncertainties and relationships and changes need to occur for open access publishing to be fully embraced. One of the biggest hurdles is getting the tenure and promotion process to decouple itself from the prestigious commercial journals. In other words, to recognize the affirmative value of publishing in open access journals, even though they might not have the cachet or might be, only having been around for a few years. Making that transition and making it compatible with promotion and tenure decisions will be an important factor going forward. There's also the Science Commons. Science Commons is a spin-off organization from the Creative Commons, which is dedicated to acting as an honest broker and catalyst to help different scientific and academic disciplines create new sorts of commonses for sharing their knowledge. One of the more important ones is it's called the Neurocommons, and the Science Commons is trying to develop some semantic web protocols to try to help aggregate the literature of neuroscience. Now, what do I mean by the semantic commons? The semantic commons is a set of meta tags and protocols for placing information about a given web artifact, a video, a text, a database, an image, saying, for example, that that document or that artifact contains important information about, let's just say, a very arcane neurological pathology. And if all of those different types of artifacts are tagged with a semantic web protocol, they can be harvested from hundreds of places throughout the World Wide Web and brought onto one's computer and organized and sifted and examined in a more efficient way. Because using Google just doesn't work. A Google search doesn't work in science because the knowledge is far more structured in very specific, refined ways. And so just a general search for a specific term will not be able to capture the kinds of highly specialized knowledge and information artifacts that one needs. So the semantic web is a set of protocols for doing that in a more efficient way, and it can greatly accelerate the acquisition and understanding of knowledge, and in turn accelerate discovery and innovation, which is what the Science Commons is chiefly dedicated to. So the Neurocommons project is really a major test project to demonstrate the utility of the semantic web protocols for developing new sorts of disciplinary commonses. The Science Commons is also known for developing an ingenious scheme to make databases, the information in databases, more available in a commons-like fashion. Part of the problem is that databases have all sorts of incompatibilities that are either technical or legal, meaning different people own them, and how can you get the data to be shareable and usable by a larger group of people, again, to accelerate discovery and innovation? Well, the solution, they realized after a while that using a copyright license like the Creative Commons licenses wouldn't work for data because there are some fundamental problems about whether data is copyrightable and what of a database is copyrightable. You can't own facts under copyright law, so can you own a copyright in the data of a database? Well, some people say the formats of how the data is organized could be copyrighted. And so you can get into a lot of debate about what's copyrightable or not in databases, but let's suffice it to say there was no reliable legal basis for developing a commons the way that they have in software or traditional content. So the ingenious solution that the Science Commons has come up with is a system where they will certify what is open data and what's shareable if certain key principles are met. And then they will give a trade, give you the permission to use a trademark certifying that it's open data. And that's the way that database contents can be committed to a commons. The Panton principles are the principles that articulate what they regard as open data, shareable data. So these are examples of the way different scientific communities are starting to reclaim their knowledge and organize it within a commons so that they can control it, rather than it being propertized, made private, made inaccessible, made incompatible with other bodies of knowledge. And that's really the major common thread through this whole story. How can knowledge be made shareable so that it can be built upon, so that improvements and new ideas and new breakthroughs can be made? And this is maybe a simple challenge in stating it, but it's a very complicated, complicated solutions are often necessary. And that's really the challenge that lies ahead in creating, reclaiming, reinventing the academic commons in the future against the enclosure that has occurred over the past 30 and 40 years. Next week, we will be talking about the media as a commons and about the enclosures of identity and community. That will be week 12.